Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We thought it was time to get Tom Nichols back on the podcast since he has been engaging in serial self-flagellation of forcing himself to watch the president's briefing. So first of all, welcome back, Tom. Good to have you.
Good to be back, Charlie.
I wouldn't have taken you for a masochist. You actually sit through these things.
You know, I at this point, it's almost like a test of wills. He's going to have these things. I as I wrote in a piece in USA Today, I said, you know, I'm a political scientist. I'm a professional. I'm going to sit through these things. And I do. And I think it's actually, I think someone should. I don't think the rest of the country needs to, you know, endure this for 2 hours a day. But I think that there should be people who just bear witness to this. Because the other part of it is, I think there has to be, some of us have to be able to turn to the rest of us and say, no, this really happened. You know, he really did threaten to shut down both houses of Congress. Yeah. He really did blame the governors for not having enough ventilators. These things really happened.
He claimed total authority over the states.
Yes, he claimed he said, we can do, the royal we, he literally said, we can do whatever we want to do.
Okay, so here's the cool kid response from the right, the too cool for school guys, the Brit Humes who say, just take a chill pill. He doesn't mean it. It's just bluster. He always says things that he doesn't mean. So this is me, you know, pay no attention to what the man is saying.
Yeah, I find that remarkably disingenuous, because what Brit and others are saying is, look, don't take the president of the United States too seriously. Learn to just tune him out. And, you know, that, I mean,
words don't matter.
Yeah, words don't matter.
Ideas don't matter.
You know, it's just grandpa yelling at the TV again. You know, he's old and crazy, but we love him. I mean, in a way, if you think about it, Trump's defenders are really, they really almost infantilize Trump. That, you know, that they want you to treat him like the little kid who comes out and says, I hate you, mommy. And then he says, oh, don't worry. He doesn't really hate you. He's a good boy. And I think that it's a bad, as a matter of civic health, it's a bad habit to get into, to say, you know, the guy who's the commander in chief, holds the nuclear codes, is the Article II, you know, part of our government. Don't listen to him. Don't take that seriously. First, they never would have said that about Obama. Every utterance Obama made was rightly so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's just too easy. The heads would have exploded. We know that.
And there's going to be another president at some point in American history, whether it's in a year or whether it's in 5 years. But there's going to be another president, and you don't want the American public, I think, in the habit of saying, "Yeah, we elected the guy," and, you know, he's in control of the military and our nuclear arsenal. But, you know, whatever. He can talk, and whatever he says doesn't matter.
See, I think it's dangerous on that level. And, you know, Daniel Dresner's written about, you know, the toddler in chief. But I also think that there's a danger in this performative authoritarianism. That's Bill Kristol's phrase about this, that it has an effect on us. And I have a piece up on at NBC Think about this. And, you know, look, you know, I'm willing to concede that Trump's performative authoritarianism, you know, doesn't make him Mussolini. It's not the same as real authoritarianism, but it's not harmless. You know, and Bill wrote something I thought was interesting. He said, can't performative authoritarian gestures lay the groundwork for more thoroughgoing authoritarian actions? And I guess that's the point, because one of the things that we ought to have learned is that democracy rests on norms that are more fragile than we had thought, right? And demagogues raise themselves up by tearing down the kind of values and the habits and the expectations that underlie liberal constitutionalism. I mean, you know, they seize power not because they are extraordinary, but because they've changed us. And so I guess it's part of the, you know, watching the president, and maybe he is blustering, but he's, you know, talking about total power and, you know, overriding Congress. And then you watch Trump world go, yeah, or the silence, the acquiescence. And you feel like, okay, we've just lost a little bit more. We've just, you know, a little bit more of the habit, a little bit more of our expectations have changed. And we've already seen the huge price we've paid for this guy. And so at some point, I do think that when you have the president of the United States, you know, talking about total control or talking about using constitutional powers that he's never used before, I mean, I think that the rational response is you take him seriously.
Absolutely. And it's destructive on several levels. I think, you know, it's amazing to me that, and I think, you know, both you and Bill were absolutely right about kind of the sedimentary effect of doing this every day. And it's amazing to me that conservatives are making the argument that it does, or let's back up and say self-identified.
Yeah.
You know, conservatives who are no longer really conservatives, because these are the same people who said, look, you have to have, you have to enforce norms and mores in society. You don't want casinos on every corner. You don't want to legalize prostitution. You don't want people smoking weed on every street corner, because it corrodes the social fabric to get you used to things that you shouldn't be getting used to. That was one of the foundational things about, I mean, you know this as a, you know, early member mm-hmm. of the conservative movement. We made the argument that how we live in public is foundational to how we conduct our politics, that you couldn't divorce them in the way that liberals said that, you know, it doesn't really matter what individual choices and what people do, you know, we're still a healthy republic. And conservatives made the argument that if you get used to bad things, then eventually that, you know, starts to degrade your politics. And here are the same people saying, oh, let the president talk like an authoritarian every day. What could that possibly hurt? Well, it gets people used to the idea that talking exactly. like authoritarian is okay. And you're absolutely right. There's one other point that I think is really important for people to get their arms around. He isn't Mussolini. He doesn't have that same level of charisma. And the other thing that's really important to understand, there's no coherence to any of this. I mean, somebody like Mussolini, you know, fascism, I really go to war with people when they say, oh, this is American fascism. Fascism is a very coherent ideology that aims at a certain kind of power. This is just Trump. I called it, in a recent piece, I called it political glossolalia. He's just like, it's like speaking in tongues. I don't think he understands what he says half the time. The danger is that people around him are looking for permission to do.
Well, that's right. And that's the thing. Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's the danger, is that when he leaves, they're still going to have those habits, right? And right. they're still going to accept all of those things.
Everything is precedent. I mean, this is something people just don't seem to want to accept about Trump. They're enjoying owning the libs so hard that they don't realize that they're setting up precedents that, you know, down the line, if a President Biden says, well, you know, I have complete authority to do X, Y, and Z. I mean, where does Mike Lee or Ted Cruz, you know, where will they get off standing up in the Senate and saying, you know, I have deep constitutional concerns about this? Well, you know, sorry, but you're 3 years too late.
You know what? I probably should have had this research. I didn't know we were going to actually talk about fascism. I'm actually racing through looking at this essay that Umberto Eco wrote about fascism. He did a definition of it, and I don't know if you've read it recently. It's really, really good as he defines what fascism is. And one of the points that he makes, and I'm going to defer to you, but one of the points that he makes is that fascism is in fact not a coherent ideology, that in fact, unlike, say, Nazism or communism, fascism is more of an attitude, and includes many things that are self-contradictory. And so it is not inconsistent to be utterly incoherent and to be a fascist. But I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. Go ahead.
Well, there is in fascism, though, even in Mussolini's kind of strutting. I mean, one thing that is kind of weird is that there are times when Trump is speaking, especially at rallies, that he actually does mimic consciously or unconsciously Mussolini's body language, you know, the jaw jutting out, the arms folded. But there is a coherent notion about the state, everything within the state, everything for the state, nothing outside of the state and its mass party. And, you know, for Trump, it's everything about me. I mean, in a sense, fascism, this is going to sound strange, fascism is a more self-assured movement than Trump is ever capable of putting together. I worry about a much more, a much less public technocratic authoritarianism behind the scenes that's done with, you know, careful manipulation of law. Like I said, I worry a lot more about people like, you know, Bill Barr, or Tom Cotton, or people that will kind of set down legislative frameworks for mm-hmm. these things rather than just some sort of statist ideology, because they're not interested in that. And even Trump isn't interested in that. Trump's just interested in survival from minute to minute. It's a bigger problem.
Here's the line that I was looking for, just to sort of to bookmark it. It says that basically fascism was a fuzzy totalitarianism, a collage of different philosophical and political ideas, a beehive of contradictions, which I thought was a great phrase.
Yes.
So we have a lot of things going on in the news, including, and I guess, you know, part of it is this the weird dissonance between watching what's actually happening in the real world, seeing the death toll from the coronavirus go above 30,000. Today's the day that we're yesterday was the day that we found out that a nursing home in New Jersey had 17 bodies stacked up. We get more than 5 million more Americans unemployed, which what brings the total to 23 million Americans who filed for unemployment in the last 3 weeks. And yet you get the president who is still virtually whistling happy days are here again, very actively pushing to open up the country in 2 weeks, saying that there's light at the head of, you know, at the end of the tunnel. And it's just a strange world. And I kind of wonder whether or not And you know, this is going to sound strange, because, and this is not meant to be a critique of, you know, media hype, that we are still not getting a picture of how much dislocation, how much despair, and how much pain Americans are experiencing right now, both in their personal lives and their economic lives. I mean, the narratives have been written, let's, you know, be honest, you know, by and for people who are, you know, are kind of hunkering down and they're sheltering in place. But there are tens of millions of people who have just got to be looking at one another going, where do I get my next meal? I mean, yeah. How am I going to pay the utilities? How am I going to pay my rent? And so this, some of this happy talk that I'm seeing, you know, on television and on social media, it's like, okay, folks, we are nowhere out of the woods in all of this. And it's almost like as if America is trying to talk itself into, okay, we've exhausted our very, very short attention spans. Can we just get back to being happy again and thinking things are okay?
Yeah. Those are the people I think that are falling in between the kind of the stay at home, you know, people like you and me, right? We're working right now. We're talking on, we're talking on a podcast to each other from across the country. And on the other end are the idiots that are trying to, you know, slam down the doors in the Ohio legislature and who are waving Confederate flags in Michigan because they're getting a lot of attention. Even though what they really want is to, you know, they're just pissed off because they want to go to Home Depot or something. In the middle are the stories, I think you're right, that aren't being told. And I think there's actually going to be a lag time on those stories, because right now, if you're not paying your bills, anybody who's ever been broke knows how this goes. And, you know, in my younger days, I was broke. That when you miss your bills, the impact does not happen the next day. It right. happens 30 days later. So I think the first wave of the, you know, the cancellations, the shutoffs, the, you know, the credit card rejections, all of those things, those are being buffered by about a 30 or 40 day window, so that when it comes to late May, I think then, if the media is doing their job, you will see a lot of stories about people, you know, getting their cable shut off, getting their cars repossessed. Now, what I'm hoping is that a lot of the infrastructure of American businesses and banks, I mean, you're already sort of seeing this slow response of saying, you know, we're not going to turn off your telephone. We're not going to repossess your car. We are not going to do. Now, if that, I think there's a real chance there for American business to really step up I don't know how optimistic I am about it, but I think those stories, Charlie, that you're talking about, I think that's absolutely right. But I think that we are in a kind of 30-day
I think you're absolutely right.
Zone where the real damage is going to be what, you know, is again, as anybody who's ever missed a bill, hasn't paid a credit card, missed their phone payment, whatever it is, that's going to happen about a month to 6 weeks from now. And that's going to be really,
I think, hard. I think this is a really important point. In fact, I got an email from a British reporter who was saying that, you know, they're trying to figure out why Trump's polling numbers haven't declined more. And my response was, well, I think that give it some time. There is a lag. There it takes time for things to settle in, for the real impact to be felt. And we're not even close to that. You know, not to mention this whole question of reopening the country is as if somehow what the federal government says or even state government says is going to change the decisions by local businessmen and the decision by consumers. You know, I'm telling you, my wife is not going to rush out and go shopping in the way that she would have a month ago. Maybe some people are, but I don't know that people are generally going to change their habits, especially as long as we don't have the testing. And if we don't have those health pieces in place, the reopening is going to be, I mean, it's going to be a foobar wrapped in a snafu. And unfortunately, it's going to be really deadly.
I just had exactly the same conversation with my wife. We're supposed to go on vacation in June. We've been planning it all year. And she just looked at me and kind of shook her head. And she said, I, you know, she was like, I don't really care if they open stuff up. I'm not really, you know, in the mood to go to a, you know, crowded pool or a beach or a busy casino or whatever it is. You know, even if she's like, I think like a lot of Americans, you know, I'd like to see a vaccine. I'd like to see some more progress. And I think that the president thinking he can just walk in and say, everything's fine, everybody go to work, everybody do what you were doing. You know, again, it's going to be interesting because, again, you talk about the people who say, well, just ignore the president. Well, I think a lot of people are going to do exactly that.
And yet,
go out there and do stuff, and they're going to go, yeah, whatever.
And yet we're already seeing this culture war divide. Now, you mentioned the demonstrations, and I want to talk about them. The demonstrations in Ohio and in Michigan. I think that's, people need to keep their eye on that. It kind of had a zombie Tea Party like vibe.
Oh, yeah.
And I wrote a piece about this today in the Bulwark, which is, you know, populist libertarianism is a thing. And the thing that people need to understand is that populist libertarianism is completely compatible with Trump's style of proto-authoritarianism. There's no tension between the sort of, you know, don't tread on me, get off my lawn sort of thing that you're seeing in some of these protests and absolute slavish devotion to Donald Trump. And he understands this. He understands and can play this. And so I do think, you know, that this sort of anti-nanny state movement out there poses a real danger on a whole bunch of levels. And my guess is that you're going to start to get more winks and nods from the conservative media. And I, you know, what's the counter on Trump beginning to tweet out support for some of these protests?
You know, the Italian that Trump most resembles is not Mussolini, it's Berlusconi. And this is exactly where Italian democracy got to under Berlusconi, which is you are totally free to do anything you want as long as you support Berlusconi at the top doing anything he wants. There's even a very good book about it called The Liberty of Servants by an Italian political scientist, where he said you are completely free as long as you understand that the man at the top is in charge and he can do whatever he wants to enrich himself and run the government. And the deal is he makes sure people leave you alone to do whatever you want as long as you leave him alone to do whatever he wants. And I think that is a, you know, pretty good description of Trumpism. You know, you mentioned polls, and I think that's important in this regard because I think we have to really contend with the reality that Trump's floor is, you know, somewhere between 38% and 40%. I would have thought it was much lower, but
yeah,
those people that are trying to, you know, bum rush the doors in Ohio, they could all end up, you know, gasping on ventilators tomorrow. And they will still croak out that it's all China's fault and Sean Hannity was right and the deep state did this and curse, you know, Tony Fauci with their last breath, because that is so woven into their identities now that they're just not capable of ever stepping out of it. And I think that has really serious consequences, not, you know, both for public health, because at some point you just say, okay, if you're one of those folks, I just don't want to be around you at all. But also for our politics, it says that there is no room left for persuasion or rational argument, that you're just going to have to outvote them by kind of force majeure, you know?
Well, I think that's where we're at here. And let me just give us like a slightly, I don't disagree, but I have a slightly different perspective on this as well, which is to understand that this sort of don't tread on me ethos, it has very deep roots, not just in the conservative movement, but as you know, in American culture. So they can tap into something. And this is something that I hope that officials keep in mind, you know, as they come up with the rules for the coronavirus, because really in something like this, you do need the consent of the governed. You need people to voluntarily go along with it. And people are, I think, overwhelmingly, you know, they want to do the right thing unless the things they're being told are just stupid. They're going too far if they think it, you know, is devolving into sort of security theater here. So, you know, people want to think that the rules make sense and they're not just, you know, arbitrary. So when you have the orders that tell churchgoers they can't have drive-in church services, even if they keep their windows closed, or, you know, banning fly fishing, which Matt LaBash wrote about in the New York Times, or this agency in Wisconsin that very briefly banned window visits at nursing homes. I actually published an email I got from somebody who said the ants, you know, town in Jersey Shore closed the boardwalk so that nobody could walk on it. And then they closed the parking lot along the boardwalk so you couldn't even, you know, pull up and look at the ocean, because maybe, I don't know, they were thinking the cars would be too close together. You know, that sort of thing can be counterproductive.
Absolutely.
Because what it does is it does erode that sense that these rules make sense. And it not only in the most extreme end, you know, will feed, you know, the moon battery that we saw in Lansing and in Ohio, but it's also going to, I don't think, kind of erode that voluntary sense that, hey, you know, this is a good idea. We should follow this because it makes sense to us.
I think this is going to kind of spread out in several directions. First of all, I think you're absolutely right that when the governors, you know, start banning, you know, looking at each other, you're going to run into problems, and they're going to have to step back from that. I mean, I think you're going to see that happen. But the other problem is every time there's something terrifying that the public, I mean, this is why we're still taking our shoes off in airports. The public will step up and say, but now I'm scared again, so do something. Right. You know, I'm my, you may have seen, I lost a family member last week. My brother passed away. But he was in a soldier's home that he wasn't actually affected by COVID, but he was in a soldier's home where we were very concerned about him because COVID just went through this soldier's home like wildfire. I mean, just today there were more cases discovered. The caregivers all have it, you know, and suddenly even these dopey regulations, you'll have people kind of shaking their head saying, okay, you know, the governor maybe is overstepping a bit, but man, you know, that piece about the soldier's home really, you know, kind of shook me up. I think the other problem you're going to have that's a social problem is that the people who are engaging in, to use the word we started with, sort of performative disobedience, right?
Right. Like people, yes,
who are just saying, well, you know what? I'm going to go and I'm going to hold a big church service, or I'm going to take 10 friends and I'm going to Home Depot just to rummage around the seed aisle, even though I live in an apartment, you know, just to show you. I think what you're going to get is a kind of mutual shunning of groups in America at a time when we really need to be coming together. You know, I think if you saw that, if I were in downtown, you know, Lansing, I'd be looking at that group and saying, I don't ever want to be around any of these people. You know, these are not civic minded people who have public safety in mind. They are doing something dangerous purely for the performative aspect of it.
And you know, it's funny. Yeah. It's funny you said that, because I was thinking the other day about, you know, this election and at the end of it, the way in which there'll be so many Americans who will think, you know, I don't even know who you are. I don't even want to be around you. And then, of course, I realized we're there, and we've been there for a very, very long time. But all of this, I think, is going to be, you know, it's going to be worsened because you know how Trump's going to react. I mean, all these kinds of protests, this kind of division, I mean, that's Trump's
hit. He feeds on it.
Yeah, these are his people. He's going to be sitting there, you know, in the private residence, and he's going to see these images, and he said, "Those are my people. I can't let them become more populist than me." He's looking at the poll numbers. There's populist cred by embracing this, you know, kind of, you know, Tea Party vibe type thing. So, and you know what he reads, you know what he watches, you know that in those reaches of the fever swamp, they love those images out of Michigan and Ohio. So so when you get the president himself, you know, playing that sort of game, I mean, the ugliness can be totally compounded. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm reading some of these things like, well, we're turning the corner and the markets are becoming more optimistic, and I'm thinking, really, are we living in different worlds?
Good luck with that.
Good luck with that.
I think that one of the things that, and I, you know, it may be a kind of a strange benefit of Trumpism, I suppose. You know, for a long time, Americans, for at least 30 years, we've lived in peace and affluence. And, you know, people say, oh, it's not peace. We're left. No, just stop. You know, the past 30 years have been almost unbroken peace and affluence and technological advancement and high levels of security and all of that stuff. And we've never had to really turn to one another and say, what is it you really believe in?
Yeah.
What kind of citizen are you really? And I think this is why the advent of Trump, I mean, in a way it's tragic, but in a way it's also clarifying. You know, I'm sure I know you and I and other people, we've lost friends or we've lost people that, you know, don't like us anymore, you know, and vice versa. And I think it's because instead of saying, yeah, you know, we both believe in pretty much the same things. We disagree about what to do about abortion. We disagree about what to do about, you know, the best way to further civil rights, the best way to spread the wealth and promote the general welfare. I mean, you know, whatever the hot button is. But we have this fundamental basis of agreement about our civic life. And now we're finding, and you know, again, this is my bias is to feel that this is more the fault of others than us. But, you know, when someone says to me, the emblematic moment of Trumpism was the woman during the shutdown who said, I don't understand why the president's doing this. He's not hurting the people he's supposed to hurt.
Oh, yeah.
And that to me is that to me would be the, you know, the thing written over the Trump library, which is, you know, going to be a rack of comic books, I guess, but to say he hurt the people he was supposed to hurt. And during a pandemic, especially, you look around and say, you're the kind of person who voted specifically to hurt other people, but now I have to trust you with my life in our common struggle against this thing. And of course, every afternoon, the president goes out there, you know, to go back to the masochism question, the president goes out there and instead of saying, my heart grieves, you know, I'm in touch with all the governors. We're working on this. It's a national emergency. He gets out there and he divides us immediately.
You're
us,
right.
Them, you, and, me.
And that's another that's another habit that's really becoming ingrained, that it is a legitimate function of the government to punish certain people.
Yes. Right?
I mean, to certain groups of people that you can smirk because it's a blue state, as opposed to a red state, something that we never even thought about.
And punish them without an attendant benefit to yourself. I mean,
you don't get anything out of it.
You don't get anything for it. I mean, you know, there was one of the standard texts on politics that every grad student has to read is Harold Lasswell's book. It's called Politics, Who Gets What, When, Where, and How, right? That's politics. Mm-hmm. We redistribute stuff all the time. I'm going to tax you. It's going to hurt. But on the other hand, I'm building a bridge over here or I'm helping somebody over there. This is a really unique moment in American politics where people are saying, look, hurt those people. And even if I'm not better off, that's okay.
That is, yes. Okay, so talk to me a little bit about China, because this appears to be one of the emerging counter narratives, and there's some truth to it. And that makes it all the more difficult to now sort out here. The, you know, what we're now learning or the possibilities. Look, I think that you can blame China and the Trump administration. You can hold those ideas at the same time, but you can see this emerging narrative that this is something that China did to us, that Donald Trump and the United States are victims. And Trump is now weaponizing this. They're going up on the air now with $10 million worth of ads in swing states talking about Joe Biden's ties to China. So we kind of know where this is going. So talk to me about China and the virus.
Well, let's start with the things that I think we could probably all agree on, that no matter how this thing started in China, the Chinese government covered it up, lied, dissembled, and made it harder for everybody. I mean, the Chinese government, without question, bears responsibility for deaths. They were not transparent. They were not forthcoming. It's not their nature as an authoritarian government to come out and say, hey, you know, to put up a flag and say, hey, we just had this problem in the city and a lot of people are getting sick and we don't know what's going on. So can everybody come in here and help us? That is not what authoritarian, you know, paranoid, secretive communist governments do. Mm-hmm. On this, I am, you know, as my friend Mark Hemingway said the other day, he said, you know, whatever your other flaws, no one has ever accused you of being going too easy on communists. With that said, I don't know where this began. I would like to know, is it possible that they were studying viruses in this lab and, you know, there was an mm-hmm. accident? Sure. It's quite possible. And if that happened, then that adds even more responsibility to the Chinese government. I think the thing that has really gotten between my teeth about people like Tom Cotton is they went right for some of the crazy pants stuff right out of the bucket. And they, no pun intended, they immunized the Chinese against further investigation and further criticism. The Chinese were already not willing to cooperate. And then you get a U.S. senator going out there and saying, well, it's awfully close to a lab like the ones that are run by militaries. And, you know, I'm not saying it was, I'm not saying it's a bioweapon or that it was deliberately released, but it's possible. Just asking questions. Well, of course the Chinese are going to say, fine. Now anybody that asks us about this, we can just hold up our hands and say, take your crazy pants, cuckoo, you know, take your cuckoo pants theories and go somewhere else. I think that was stupid and destructive, because I do think we need to know more about what China knew, what their culpability is here. But as you said a moment ago, none of that excuses Trump's cloddish flat-footedness about this, because back in January, even the Chinese, even the World Health Organization were both saying, hey, everybody hunker down here. There's a problem coming. We're not sure how bad it's going to be, but this is now an elevated concern. And the president, you know, held rallies and golfed and said, it's like a miracle. It's going to, you know, the accordion hands started like a miracle. It's going to be gone. Like nobody knows. Nobody's ever seen it. It'll be gone away. Kayleigh McEnany, the new press secretary, you know, was on Fox back then saying it won't come to America because Donald Trump is so awesome.
Hey, could you help me with something? You know, since you're a professor in higher education and everything, Kaylee. All right. Yeah. She's got a degree from Harvard. I mean, yep. is she really smart and she just pretends to be something different? I struggle with some of these people. I mean, I do understand that at a certain point they must say to themselves, look, okay, I've been to Harvard and Oxford and everything, but I need to use these words. I need to sound this way. I need to act this way in order to get what I want. Is it an act or what?
Well, it's a great question. And I've known many such students, and there are two ways to think about this. One is that I always use a quote by Robert Tucker, the great historian Robert Tucker, who said about Stalin once, he said, to treat opportunism as incompatible with deeply held beliefs is to take a simplistic view of political man, that people find a way to weave their opportunism into pre-existing beliefs, even when they're intelligent enough to know otherwise. But I think when you ask the Harvard, and I don't speak for Harvard, of course, or any other institution, when you ask that question about people like Kaylee or Laura Ingraham, right? Who went to Dartmouth.
Dartmouth.
You know, Dinesh D'Souza, who went to Dartmouth. You know, Ted Cruz, Princeton and Harvard. You know, these people are all graduates of elite universities. And my experience with students like that is they are incredibly maze bright. That is, they know how to run through the maze to find the piece of cheese. And they are very good at going to school. They are very good at standardized exams. They have very high, mathematical or maze bright skills, but they are completely morally hollow. They chase the piece of cheese around and say, yeah, but I don't really care about anything else. I mean, I think one of the things that we have to internalize about this is being smart and being wise are not the same thing. You know, smart is a skill set that gets you through a set of tasks in a good university, but that doesn't mean that you're a good person or that you are capable of reflection. It means that you can grind out an A by knowing, you know, kind of understanding the internal logic of the system. And I think that she and a lot of others are exactly like that.
You know, you and I have both known a lot of people over the years who've been involved in politics, some of whom have held office. And I've known some folks who were extremely bright and had extremely bad judgment. Yes. And a couple of people come to mind, people who were so smart and so verbally skilled, I think, that they could talk themselves into believing whatever they wanted to believe. You could watch them doing it, which meant that they were very unreliable when it came to figuring out what they were going to do or whether they were going to make the right decision. That these were the kinds of people that always wanted to be the smartest person in the room. What they really needed was some normal human being to raise their hand at the back of the room and say, you know, what you're saying now is completely ridiculous. It makes no sense. But that didn't happen. And so whereas some of the people who I think were the most effective political leaders that I've ever seen were not necessarily the brightest guys in the room, but they were able to, you know, they were able to surround themselves with people of both character and intelligence. So, yeah, I think the gap between smart and wise is something to always keep in mind.
And to surround yourself with people where you're not going to shoot the messenger. you know, I have two quick things to one's a story. When I was advising the late Senator Hines years ago, he asked me about some shipments that were coming from Central America and Cuba that were, you know, running guns and doing bad things. And back in this was still at the end of the Cold War. And he said, well, you know, why don't we just get rid of these things? Why doesn't the government, you know, why doesn't the CIA or somebody, you know, and he sort of, said this off the top of his head. And I thought for a minute, I said, well, because some nosy senator like you, you know, is going to hold a hearing and ask how that happened. And there was this quiet moment. He looked at me and said, yeah, I guess I see your point.
Yeah. You
know, it's great to have somebody in the room who just kind of reminds you that, okay, you know, there's another person here who actually can hear how that sounds. And I think the other problem with highly intelligent people is that they have been told that they are highly intelligent. And therefore, that becomes kind of a security blanket. Yeah. You know, I actually think, and of course, I have a reputation for being this kind of arrogant, overbearing, I know everything guy.
I have heard this.
You know, I'm obnoxious and disliked. That cannot be denied. So, but you know, I have to say that in my own work, I always tell my students, I teach a writing class, I never work without an editor. Never. No, nothing ever leaves my desk and goes public that at least one or two people, including my wife, who's a very sensible person, you know, just kind of looks at it so they can look at me and say, you really mean to say that?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really, that's how you don't fall in love with your own intelligence. But I think that when you are, as you approach positions of power, you are taught to fall in love with your, and I think in the academic community, my community, this is an occupational hazard all the time because you're standing in front of 30 young people who, if you say the moon is made of green cheese, they all go, well, I guess that's going to be on the test, you know, and they write it down. So I think it's really important to always have, and of course, to bring this back to the current administration, there's nobody in that room who does that.
No, and I mean, absolutely not. I would know, as you were saying that, I think the people who are most at risk, you know, obviously people in public life, but even more so, billionaires, millionaires, people who are really, really rich. because they really can create an environment where no one around them is ever going to tell them that they are anything but brilliant, and everybody laughs at their jokes. And so there are some that I've met that keep that sense of, you know, that keep a sense of humor about it, that they actually understand that as soon as they got rich or they got the job that they had, they suddenly became, you know, better looking, thinner, and much, much funnier. But they're in on the joke. But you combine, you know, that sort of, you know, billionaire bubble with the absolute power of the presidency, and you get, and it's like, it's not just squared. It's just, it is just exponential.
Right. Logarithmic.
Even a United States senator at a certain point has to go out and meet real people in the real world, many of whom will tell him to his or her face that they're full of shit. You know, that's the great thing about the electoral system. But there are people who are completely insulated from all of that. We kind of made a digression there, but it was good.
I think it's actually worth pointing out. I mean, it happens in every walk of life, and it happens in government. It happens in the military. I mean, I've met senior military officers who, you know, one of my colleagues used to refer to the problem of colonel-itis, that, you know, once you've become a colonel, you say, listen, if I needed advice from you, I wouldn't have this old bird on my shoulder here.
Yeah, right.
You know, or the admiral who says, you know, if I needed your advice, I wouldn't have three of these sitting on my shoulder. This can happen. You know, if I needed input about, you know, my teaching, I wouldn't be a full professor, and on and on and on. And I think, to go back to your point about Cayley, McEnany, and people like that, they may look around and say, well, you may not think I'm smart, but which one of us is the press secretary in the White House?
To the president, right.
You know, and they don't understand that may be a triumph of a certain kind of, you know, mouse pushing the buttons in the maze intelligence, but that it is a complete moral failing, and that to be smart is not the same thing as being wise or moral.
So I'm actually looking right now at social media, which is Twitter. And I think one of the coolest things to come out of this whole period of time is a site called Room Raider.
I saw that.
Room Raider, which actually is, and I'm jealous because I have not been rated. And what this is this specifically rates people's Skype rooms, because none of us are doing TV from studio, so we're all at home. And there's a wide variety, and you got rated. I have not been rated, although I think my Skype room is great. But it says, I have to say that I'm impressed with your background. You got lots of books, as you'd expect. We'll take off a point because of the Indian food thing.
Yes.
So you only got a 7 out of 10.
I'm a little pissed, you know, because I've looked at Room Raider's ratings, and, you know, 8 out of 10 is a really good rating.
Yeah, yeah.
And I only scored a 7. You know, I said hashtag rigged. When that came up, because I'm being punished for something that has nothing to do with my room. And so I feel like I'm at the Olympics, you know, the Indian judge, you know, took a point off. But yes, actually what you see on Skype is it's just my home office. It's where I work. And even though it looks, you know, very nice, it is really done up in modern IKEA.
Which is great. So, you know, I'm in my kitchen. You can't really tell, but I'm in my kitchen. By the way, so just so you know, Chris Coons, the senator, he only got a 3 out of 10. Walter Isaacson he just raised the bar. He got a 9 out of 10.
Is it his home, though, or there's some, because there's somebody who does it from a conference room, and it looks like the briefing room on the USS Enterprise.
Yeah, I don't know. The Walter Isaacson is pretty good, though. Lindsey Graham got a 0, but I think that's more about Lindsey than about his room.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham's room was really nasty. I mean, it was just, it looks like he was in the alcove of a, you know, on his way to the men's room in an Italian restaurant or something.
Yeah, Pete Buttigieg really only got a 4, so you're like way higher than Pete Buttigieg. So, I mean, there's, you know, some people, and Mike Huckabee.
Yeah, don't even.
Let's see here. You got the same rating as David Frum, which is pretty good.
Yeah, although David's library, again, you know, David has real wood. I have IKEA wood. But my big problem with my Skype rating in general is for some reason, the last time I did it, it was at night, and I had, I don't know why my lights were set up wrong, but I was bathed in this orange light, and I looked like I was wearing Trump's makeup with a trowel. Okay. And I looked awful. I mean, I was bathed in this kind of sickly orange light. So, you know, I'm hoping that the next time I do a Skype, I can find the, you know, one of my friends in Hollywood said, you know, you need a key light and a fill light and a this light and a that light. But maybe I can up my rating the next time by not looking like I just emerged from the crypt.
Yeah.
In my room.
This act, I don't think anybody looks good on Skype cameras, by the way. Nobody. Although it is certainly much more convenient than the old way of doing it. So, I mean, you wonder all the things that are going to change the world. And it's like maybe NBC and CNN will go, hey, you know, we save a lot of money on studios by the Skype because what is the net cost to them is what? Zero. Yeah. So
I was going to say, I'm hoping it doesn't change that because, you know, I've switched over now for my the courses I teach at the Harvard Extension School. I teach by Zoom now. And, you know, it can be a real boon, especially for people that are in multiple time zones and, you know, can't make it to a classroom. But I don't want us to lose that human contact. I mean, you've done a ton of television. You know the difference in the dynamic between being in studio and being on a remote. You know, in studio, you're having a real conversation. On a remote, you're sort of waiting for the cue to remember that, you know, you should participate. I mean, I think it takes something away from us to do everything by distance and electronically. And I'm actually hoping that one of the things we take away from this pandemic is we don't really like it that much, you know, that it's like, yeah, we all try to, because I think this got a lot of us over our reticence to do this, right? Say, hey, we should do more Skype interviews. We should do more Zoom classes. And people said, I don't want to try it. It's too hard. Now we have to do it. And I'm hoping that in the end, we take a very sensible approach to say, hey, this is a great thing to have in your back pocket. It's a great backup. It's a really nice addition to the toolkit. But the best thing in life is to be in the company of other human beings.
See, this is, we have a slightly different perspective on this because I've just discovered that being around other people is highly overrated.
I say that, you know, it's funny because, you know,
I get to spend more time with my dogs.
Being an academic. And a cat person. Absolutely. My cat is loving the pandemic. She's just got, you know, my wife and me all day to herself. But as an academic, I don't, you know, we don't work in our offices. That our offices are there kind of as a convenience. They're not, you know, we do a lot of our work at home and we do it off hours. So to transition to this wasn't so hard. In fact, you know, when this first started and they said, stay at home, don't come to your office, avoid your colleagues. I'm like, well, that's been pretty much my ethos for 25 years. But I still think it's really important. I like being in the same room as my students. I do like to see my colleagues in person. I do like having the occasional meeting. You know, as Chairman Mao said, there should not be too many meetings and they should not go on too long. But every now and then I do see a, you know, real value in that. And I'm hoping that people don't take the easy way and say, you know, from now on, I just want to go to meetings in my bunny slippers. With a mug of coffee, you know, off camera. I think that would be a bad lesson to draw from this.
So speaking of bunny slippers, I wish that I had been smart enough to have anticipated and invested in all of the countries that are selling jogging pants and bunny slippers, because I'm guessing the explosion of leisure wear, especially below the waist leisure wear, is truly awesome right now.
You know, this is not going to surprise you, and it will not surprise anybody listening who follows me on Twitter. I am right now wearing a pair of slacks, loafers, and a button-down Brooks Brothers shirt. I have just decided that if I don't do that, then I am giving up, and I will just plod around the house in my sweatpants and t-shirts and never get anything done. So I have adopted the, you know, even though I am not at work, I am going to work approach. And I don't
switch. I admire that. I admire that. And I say that as somebody who is unshaven, in a t-shirt, wearing sweats, and some really ratty tennis shoes.
I can't see this right now in my head. It's good that we don't have video, because in my head you look like you always do, and now I have that totally other now I have that visual of you that you look like if I were bailing you out on a Saturday morning.
So it's funny because my wife said, "Don't say that on the podcast. Don't have people imagining what you really look like." So because I actually did do a Skype thing the other day where I put on from my kitchen where I put on. The shirt, I put on the Brooks Brothers shirt, I put on a jacket, I put on a red tie. I actually, from my waist up, I looked very, very professional. So the illusion held at least for about 10 minutes. And now I will confess
that once, it wasn't the last time I was on, but there was a Skype hit I did a while back where it was jacket and tie from the waist up and PJs and slippers from
you
the
see?
Waist up.
All right. You know,
but, see, this you is know, that was, that's sometimes, you know, that's like in the summertime when you go to the studio and you throw the jacket on, but you're actually wearing, you know, shorts and flip flops or, you know, boat shoes or whatever you're wearing. It's occasionally acceptable. I just find that if I walk around the house that way, I'm not going to get anything done. Like I can't, you know, I can't even answer an email. At that point, I just sit down and say, I have to catch up on years of computer gaming. And I just want to, I'm trying to be more productive. I don't know how long it's going to hold out. But I am still putting on clean shirts for now.
Okay. You are an inspiration to us all. Tom Nichols, thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. You're always one of our favorite guests, and I appreciate all of your time.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.